So today we're looking at Dhammapada verse 281, which reads as follows: Vajanurakhi manasasusamuto kayena cha na kusalangaira ete tayo kamapatthe visodhaye aradhaye Magamisi Paveditam, which means, one with guarded speech, well restrained in mind, and one should not perform any unwholesomeness with body. When one purifies these three means of action, one attains the path taught by the sage. So this verse was taught in regards to a spirit or a ghost. The story is a relatively long one. So the story itself is simple. One day Moggallana and another monk were coming down from Gijakuta, the vulture's peak above the city of Rajgaha. So this is a mountain, and the Buddha stayed there and many monks stayed there. It was a known place where the Buddhist monks, where the Buddha and his followers would spend time. And so they would stay up on the mountain and come down in the morning for alms. And one day Moggallana and this other monk were coming down, and at a certain spot Moggallana smiled, and the other monk asked Moggallana, why are you smiling? And Moggallana said, well, now isn't the time. Wait, when we go to see the Buddha, the teacher, you can ask me then and I'll answer. So they went for alms and ate their meal and went to see the Buddha. And when they sat in front of the Buddha, this monk asked Moggallana again, well, what is it that you that made you smile? And Moggallana said, well, I didn't want to say anything because without a witness, who's going to believe it? But it was such a curious thing. I saw an enormous ghost. Spirit, a being, an ethereal being that normal people can't see, but Moggallana had the capacity to see things that ordinary people couldn't see. And this ghost was incredible. It was huge, but with the shape of a human, but its head was the head of a pig. And where its mouth should have been, there was a rear end instead. And out of this orifice came maggots, spewing out maggots. It was the most grotesque thing. And he said, I thought to myself, I've never seen such a thing in all of my life. And as a result of that, I smiled. Such a strange and wonderful, not wonderful, really terrible. But this is the nature for arahants of their smile, that often it has nothing to do with something being funny. It's more the incredible nature of samsara, what is possible, and the absurdity or the craziness of things. And when Moggallana said this in the presence of the Buddha turned around and said, when I first became enlightened, I saw that being as well. In my examination, the Buddha spent time after his enlightenment observing the various types of beings in the world. And I said, I saw this being, but I didn't want to say anything because I knew no one would believe me. Well, not that no one would, but he said, the Buddha said, if there were people who didn't believe me, it would be to their detriment. You know, they might become skeptical and think the Buddha was making things up or something like that, having doubts about. So the Buddha didn't say that something because it's quite dubious to suggest that such a being could even exist. And the monks asked, well, how does it come about that such a being actually exists? And the Buddha said, well, this is a because of occurrences that happened in a past life. And he told the story. So this story I'm going to tell because it's what actually relates to the verse. The story goes that there were two monks in the time of a past Buddha. And they were so incredibly harmonious and in tune and such strong friends that they did everything together. They lived in the forest. They went on alms round together. They lived completely in complete harmony. One of them was a year senior to the other one. So he had ordained a year before the other. And in the long run, that's not such a big deal. Buddhist monks go according to seniority. So a junior monk will pay respect to a senior monk and will often perform duties for the senior monk. But 1 year apart, oftentimes monks would probably think, well, that we're basically equals. It's not true, but the feeling would arise with less scrupulous monks thinking, well, no, just 1 year, it's not a big deal, or so on. But these monks, the junior of these two monks, he was so humble and so had such great affection for the other monk and respect that he acted as though he was just a newly ordained novice monk or a pupil. And so he performed all the duties as though he were just a newly ordained monk, taking it as an opportunity to do something for the other monk because they had such affection and love for each other. I mean, friendly. They were such close friends. And so they lived in complete harmony, and they lived in a place where the lay people appreciated them, and they were beloved by their community, and well taken care of. And so everything appeared to be ideal. They were practicing the Buddha's teaching. They appeared to have been meditating. And it seems that they didn't get too far in their meditation for whatever reason, but they may have been on their way there. And then it happened that a third monk came to the monastery. I guess it was a remote area, so not lots of monks. But a third monk came. And this monk was a Dhamma teacher, someone who knew much of the Buddha's teaching and was able to give teachings on the Dhamma. He was well proficient in the art of speech, the art of speaking, you know, the art of oration, giving talks. So he was able to present the teaching, he was able to explain it, he was able to provide similes and examples and impress upon others the value and the purpose and the meaning of the teaching. And so the other two monks were quite excited about this, quite happy to have this monk come, thinking, well, we aren't able to give talks in the way that this monk is, so this will be a great thing to have him come to our monastery. And so they said to him, please, will you teach the Dhamma? And so he got up on the Dhamma chair and he preached the Dhamma, and the lay community was able to listen and the monks were able to listen, and they were so happy that this monk had come. So they brought him on alms round to this village or that village and introduced him to the community. And this monk gave talks, and they were so happy. The community and the monks were so happy to have this third monk who could teach the Dhamma, helping them all out, supporting them in their practice, providing them with food for thought and encouragement. And also the happiness of being able to hear the Buddha's teaching regularly. But it turns out this third monk was not nearly as interested in harmony as the other two. It turns out he had quite a greedy nature and manipulative nature. So even though he taught the Dhamma, it doesn't appear that he was very keen on practicing it, or else having come to this place that turned out to be quite comfortable based on the reputation that the other two monks had gained. So it was well supported. The lay people were providing everything, anything the monks could need, probably providing them with choice types of food and lodging and robes and medicines, whatever they needed. So they were kind of a little bit spoiled even, perhaps. Anyway, it appeared to this monk that this was a sort of a cushy sort of arrangement. And he thought to himself, well, these two monks are pretty easy to manipulate. Soft, he thought of them as. So what if I were to find a way to get rid of them? and then I would be able to run this monastery and reap all the rewards and live in great comfort. Not the best sort of intention, and quite surprising for someone who is so well versed in the Dhamma, but there you have it. And so here's what he did. These two monks that were so harmonious and so friendly towards each other, he drove them apart. Started with the senior monk. He went to him and said, "Venerable sir, there's something I should tell you." And the senior monk said, "Oh, what do you have to say?" He said, "Well, it's something that has great is worthy of great censure. I mean, something really bad that would be, you'd have to give punishment for it, or you'd have to give reprimand if someone were to do it." He said, "Oh, well, what could that be?" And the other monk didn't say anything and turned and walked away. So he didn't say anything really, but he instilled suspicion and doubt in the senior monk. Then he went to the junior monk and said the same thing. And he did this every day, went to the senior monk and said, "Look, there's something I really have to say, but it's so terrible that if you found out, it would be something that worthy of such censure," meaning you'd have to take action. And he worked them into a bit of a frenzy. And then finally he said to the senior monk, he said, "Well, here's the case. How well do you know the junior monk, your friend?" He said, "Oh, well, we are like brothers, even though we're not related. I know everything about him. I've known him forever, and we are incredibly close. We are of like mind, and there's nothing." And the preacher monk, the Dhamma teacher monk, said, "Well, that's strange, because he said to me, he said, if you think the senior monk is well behaved, you better investigate that further." That's how the Pali goes. Basically saying, if you think he's a good monk, you're probably wrong. And he doesn't say that outright. And I think he's saying it this way to avoid lying. Although he is lying. He's lying because this other monk didn't say this, but to avoid making some actual accusation. So he phrases it that way, that if you think the senior monk, he's told me that if you think the senior monk is well behaved, you should investigate further. And the senior monk was incensed. He was enraged. He couldn't believe it. How could this junior monk say such a thing? And of course, he didn't suspect the Dhamma teacher, because when you hear someone teaching the Dhamma again and again, you get a feeling that they are living the Dhamma, right? Why would they teach it if they're not living it? And the preacher monk went, the Dhamma teacher went away and went to the junior monk and said exactly the same thing. He said, "Well, do you know the senior monk very well?" "Oh, yes, I know him very well." "Well, then why did he say to me that if you think the junior monk is well behaved, you should investigate further?" Said the same thing. Very mild sort of words, but it created such animosity because of how he worked them into it, and created this breach of harmony, a schism, and discord between the two. It's funny, because I think the fact that he didn't outright make accusations or claim that they had made accusations meant that it was hard for them to then go to the other monk and say, "Hey, did you accuse me of this or accuse me?" Because there was no accusations being spoken about. There was only the suspicion being raised. And so as a result, they just got angry about it. And so the next morning, the junior monk was getting ready for alms, and he thought, "Well, should I wait for the senior monk?" And he thought, "No, I'll go on my own." And so he went on his own for alms, and the senior monk saw that the junior monk wasn't there and went on his own for alms as well. And for the first time since they had been ordained, they didn't go on alms round together. Then they came back after alms, and they came to the dana sala, the eating hall, kitchen, the dining room. And the junior monk would normally, when they got back, he would take the senior monk's bowl. It's something that a pupil would do for the teacher, but he was doing for the senior monk just out of love and out of friendliness and harmony. And today he thought to himself, should I take his bowl? No, I won't take his bowl. And then he thought to himself, well, maybe I should. And he went to the senior monk anyway, even though they were really angry and he was really angry at him. And he said, please give me your bowl, venerable sir. And the senior monk said, you don't need, what are you doing taking my bowl? I don't need, why do you think I need you to take my bowl? And the junior monk said, well, I also thought maybe I wouldn't take your bowl. And so over such a small thing, they again got, well, the anger came out in the open and they were now really upset at each other. And so the senior monk said to him, what, do you think I'm attached to this monastery? Do you think, maybe you think that I'm going to stay here if you're acting in this way? And the junior monk said, well, what, do you think I'm attached to this monastery, that I'm going to stay here if this is the way things are? And they both decided then and there, I guess, maybe it was a little more heated and they were actually getting angry at each other, but this is what the Pali says. They both decided on that day that they were going to leave the monastery. And they went to the third monk, the Dhamma teacher, and they said to him, you stay here, you can stay and run the monastery. And the Dhamma teacher said, oh no, please don't go. But he said it, I guess, in such a way as well that probably didn't make them change their minds. And so one went out the west gate and one went out the east gate, and they went in opposite directions, leaving behind the monastery that they lived at for so long. The Dhamma teacher monk went into the village and told the community, the lay people, that these two monks had left, had gone on their ways, and that he wasn't really sure what was going on. But the community, the village people, thought to themselves, well, these two monks were in complete harmony until this Dhamma teacher monk came. He must have had something to do with it. And the Pali says that they were just very sad. Probably the implication is that they stopped supporting the monastery in the way that they did before. I mean, certainly they wouldn't, because they were really really revered the two monks who had left, and really upset that they had decided to just run away. And so quite likely the comfortable situation that this monk had been hoping for never really materialized, because the people would lose faith and confidence, which often happens when a monastery falls into disharmony. Meanwhile, these two monks, now estranged, traveled across the countryside from monastery to monastery and had such feelings of remorse and sadness and bitterness towards themselves and towards the other monk, that for all of their time spent apart, they were never able to gain any sort of tranquility or insight or any kind of progress or value from the Buddha's teaching. Their minds were just consumed with unwholesome qualities. Until one day in their travels, just by chance, I guess over the years, they happened to be at the same monastery, arrived at one place and suddenly saw the other monk coming into the same monastery. And the junior monk thought to himself, there he is, there's the monk I used to live with. And he thought, maybe I shouldn't talk to him, maybe it will just lead to more anger. And then he realized, he just said to himself, what are you, crazy? This has caused such stress and suffering for you, why would you even think that? And so he swallowed his pride, went to the senior monk, paid respect to him, and said to him, hello, venerable sir, and greeted him, and then asked him, he said, venerable sir, in all the time we lived together, did you ever know me to have any sort of fault worth reprimanding? And the senior monk said, no, of course not. And the junior monk said, then, well, why did you say that about me? Why did you tell the Dhamma teacher monk such lies about me? And the senior monk said, I never said such a thing. Why did you say such a thing about me? I never said such a thing. And so then they realize. And now they were again probably a little bit angry, but now angry at the proper source, or the proper object. And together they traveled back to the monastery where they used to live and confronted the Dhamma teacher monk. Dhamma teacher monk tried to take their robes or their bowls, tried to greet them and do the duties towards them. And they snapped their fingers. This is what you'd do in India at the time, I guess. Snapped their fingers and said, it's no longer suitable for you to stay here, brother. Bhikkhu. And chased him out of the monastery, it says. And he left, or they didn't chase him, but he realized that he had been found out and realized that he had done such a terrible thing. And so he fled the monastery. And these two monks lived happily ever after. It doesn't say what happened to them. There's no mention of what happened to them. All it mentions is that this monk who fled the monastery spent the rest of his life in great suffering, with strong feelings of guilt and remorse, shame and stress and unwholesomeness. When he died, he was born in hell. And when the power of the deed that he had performed in this life was extinguished, he was reborn as a ghost. So not completely extinguished, but the power that led him to hell was extinguished. He was reborn, but he was reborn as this incredibly unpleasant ghost, suffering from great, from having a mouth like a rear end, with maggots coming out of his mouth, I guess. So the Buddha told this story, and then he said to the monks, it's a good example, monks, of why one should be guarded in body, speech, and mind. And then he taught this verse, Wa janu rakhi, one should guard one's speech. Manasa susamuto, one should be well controlled or well restrained in mind. Kayena cha na kusalang kaira, and one should not perform any unwholesomeness with body. Ete tayo kamapate visodhiye, having purified these three means of action. Magamisi aradaye magamisi paveditam, one attains the path taught by the sage, by the Buddha, who was the isi. So, lots to unpack here, really. The story has lots of good lessons for us that are, some of them are obvious, some of them maybe not so much. The most obvious one is the power of gossip. How easy it is to destroy harmony. How easy it is to create suffering, and how incredibly evil it is to spread false gossip. I experienced this firsthand when I was a young monk living in a forest monastery. There was one man posing as a monk, and I say posing as a monk because I knew this because he was a thief, and a thief cannot be a monk. When a monk steals, they're no longer a monk at that moment. And he was a thief, and he was a kleptomaniac as far as I could see. It wasn't that he needed any money, or it wasn't even about need. It was just constant stealing whatever he could get his hands on. I didn't realize it at first, but I realized it over time. And that's not the interesting part of the story. The interesting part of the story is how he went about succeeding. Because no one, the monastery couldn't come together to catch him or to kick him out, because they were fighting with each other. Because he had gone around to every single monk in the monastery and told them stories about all the other monks, and raised such animosity in the monastery. It was really remarkable to see. I only sort of realized this over time, and by that time I was already being attacked by other monks, just for no reason. But he had created such discord, and I realized he was doing this because that discord allowed him to do whatever he wanted. The monks couldn't get together and say, "Hey, look, let's do something about this monk," because everyone was. And he was a friend to everyone because he was so ingratiating with all the monks. He would go to a monk and say, "Oh, you wouldn't believe that monk over there. He did this and this and this." And then he would go to the other monk and say, "You wouldn't believe that other monk. He did this and this." It was really quite impressive. dangerous, dangerous thing and incredibly evil. Obviously, the consequences are dire. Not so much for, well, for both sides, really. Both for those who are the recipients, because they end up cultivating such unwholesomeness. These two monks spend all that time unable to practice as a result of allowing themselves to be manipulated in this way. Clearly, they didn't have any strength of practice, or else they wouldn't have been able to. But it's so insidious. Gossip, because you're given a narrative, and you build up this boogeyman in your mind when someone talks about someone else as being evil in this way. People are already only ideas, and they only exist in our minds. When you think of a certain person, your parents, your spouse, your children, your friends, all of them are just ideas in our mind. They don't actually exist, but we build up those ideas based on evidence, usually based on our interactions with them. But when we're given secondhand evidence, it's like reading a book where you learn about an individual, all of their characteristics, and they're only a fiction. But you create this in your mind. You have an idea of who they are. And this idea can be totally based on lies. This is what gossip does. It's such an insidious sort of thing that even those who are generally good people can be taken in a wrong direction by it. I mean, a really good lesson is, first of all, no anger is ever justified. Even if you know of someone who's incredibly evil, no good comes from hating them. And if you take that as a first principle, you'll never fall into this problem. Even if you think, oh boy, this is reliable, this person has said that person is a terrible person, okay. It still doesn't lead you to such anger or disharmony. Which leads us to the second lesson. Harmony is incredibly important. It's important, and I think worth stressing, the idea of promoting harmony and allowing for the faults of others to go unpunished to a certain extent. That unless someone crosses a line and is verified or even accused of doing something very specific, like breaking an important rule, like killing or stealing or lying or cheating or taking drugs or alcohol or something like that. Really, the best course of action is first and foremost to try and maintain harmony. Find ways to benefit this person. Think of the welfare of and the well-being of this person who has engaged in unwholesome behavior. If the person is gossiping, for example, if a monk says, oh, that other monk's a terrible monk, first and foremost, try and change that about this monk who is spouting lies or maligning other people's good name or that sort of, you know, speaking bad about others. Or whatever. If someone gets angry, even if someone yells at you, even if someone hits you or punches you, your best reaction is obviously never to get angry back, to fight back. The best is, if and when possible, to try and restore and maintain whatever harmony you can, to not rock the boat. And again, unless something terrible has been committed, if someone has done terrible things, then certainly those have to be dealt with. And if someone crosses a line, you can't sweep it under the rug, so to speak. But absolutely, harmony is incredibly important. And as I've already mentioned some of the ways, the first, of course, is that towards our practice, our individual practice can't thrive if we're constantly at war, harboring and cultivating feelings of animosity towards each other. We absolutely have to guard this and cherish it. In a monastery, in a meditation center like this, it's quite probable that there will from time to time arise disagreements. There will arise anger and animosity and grudges against one another. And these are the sorts of things that we have to be very careful to work out, to guard against, and to find ways to free ourselves from. One of the great ways is communication, obviously, which can be difficult, but sometimes it just means clearing up misunderstandings or expressing grievances. This is why we have every year at the end of the rains, we have a time where anyone can air their grievances if they truly have some terrible thing that they have to accuse someone of or something like that. They have to make someone aware of their bad behavior, that sort of thing. But harmony is incredibly important. And this is a lot of, for those of you who are not monks and just coming to the monastery for a short time, it's still important for your practice here and outside to be constantly aware of this this quality of harmony, harmony with the people around you, harmony with your environment. This is why we encourage everyone to express kindness towards all the beings in the monastery. Sometimes there can be spirits who will try to disturb your practice or who are unhappy about us or for whatever reason, usually for their own reasons. But overall, harmony with each other, harmony with the community is very important. It's important to not disturb other meditators with loud noises. It's important not to disturb others with speech, to get caught up in conversing or engaging in socializing with each other. This sort of thing is the same sort of idea applies to maintaining the sanctity of the center of the residence. This is one of the seven things the Buddha said doesn't leads to the non-decline or prevents the decline of the Buddha sasana. The third lesson is an obvious one that we hear often in the Buddhist teaching, that obviously or clearly study and teaching of the Buddha's teaching doesn't equate to practice of the Buddha's teaching. Now both study and practice benefit from and benefit in turn the practice of the Buddha's teaching, but they don't necessarily go in hand. It is certainly possible to teach the Buddha's teaching, study the Buddha's teaching without gaining any depth of practice. It's also quite possible for study and teaching to distract you from your own practice and lead to corruption and eventually to this sort of thing that this monk fell into. It may have been that when he ordained or throughout his monastic life, he had some good intentions, but it can happen that if you engage overly, investing too much time and energy into study, into teaching, that your own practice suffers and your mind becomes agitated and you're unable to focus, and as a result, defilements have an opportunity to grow and to manifest in this sort of way. It still doesn't excuse by any means what this monk did. It was a terrible thing and a sign of a real lack of moral fiber, no? Lack of good character on his part. But nonetheless, be careful not to mistake the fact that study and teaching are, mistake them as the same thing as actual practice of the Buddhist teaching, because they absolutely aren't. It's really a different skill to be able to study, and it's a different skill even more to be able to teach. Some monks are great practitioners but not very good at teaching. Some people are very good at teaching but not very good at practicing. And the final lesson, I guess, is just a minor note that it's remarkable and it's worth remarking how evil blinds you to the truth. It blinds you to the nature of things. I mean, it's remarkable that these two monks were so easily manipulated, and it's remarkable that this monk who knew so much about the Dhamma was unable to appreciate it and unable to keep to it. It's remarkable that someone could teach the Buddha's teaching and yet do such a horrible thing to another living being, to be a monk dedicated to the teaching. But likewise, with these two monks, it's also remarkable that their harmony was so easily disrupted. Harmony is a fragile thing, but clearly these two monks were not well and truly grounded in the Buddha's teaching. And all it took was some anger to blind them to all the years that they had spent together and blind them to the truth of the Buddha's teaching, how it could prevent them from letting go, you know, how it could make them so obsessed with this speech of the speech that they had been told about of the other monk. All in all, a good story about how not to live and what not to do. how not to find peace and happiness, and how to not act when your peace and happiness your life is disturbed, how not to act on many fronts. As for the verse is a very simple lesson, a lesson that we've talked about before and studied before. It's the three doors. We call these the three doors. The Buddha here calls them the kamapatha, the paths of action or the means of action, ways by which we do things. And by do things, of course, the Buddha meant do ethical and unethical acts, do karmically potent acts. So you can do something that has karmic repercussions through body, through speech, or through mind. And the Buddha put speech here first, I guess because of the story. You know, this verse was taught based on this story. So he starts with speech because the story is about speech, right? This monk didn't guard his speech. You could say that these other two monks also didn't guard their speech. When it came to a confrontation, they were both guilty of speaking words that only inflamed the situation rather than trying to diffuse it. Whereas, I mean, clearly, if someone had said such things about you, you're much better off trying to just diffuse the situation or just letting it slide. Well, this person says I'm a terrible monk. Good, that's a good reminder of me that I have to always be trying to improve myself. It would be a much better way to look at it. So clearly there's an inability to guard their speech. But well, speech is difficult to guard. Speech is something that we have to pay close attention to because it's much easier, and this is a lesson we get from the story as well, it's much easier to perform ethical and unethical acts by speech than it is with action, with body. Body is coarse, body is gross, is obvious, and it is relatively, compared to the others, relatively easy to restrain the body. You know, not killing, not stealing. For someone engaged in the practice of the Buddha's teaching, it's not that difficult to refrain from stealing from your fellow monks, for example, as this one man was unable to do. Refrain from killing. Yes, sometimes you react based on instinct, killing a mosquito or something like that. And actually, over time, you're pretty quickly able to work through that. But speech is difficult. It's one of the reasons why we encourage meditators to not speak. We have a rule not to chat. And if and when you do speak, to be careful and to try and speak only as necessary, only as appropriate during the course, because it's such a volatile sort of activity. It's very easy to slip into something that is false, to slip into speech that is manipulative, even speak a lie without really intending to. Very hard to keep good speech without strong mindfulness. Speech is a very quick, something that we're very quick to give rise to without thought, without the support of strong mindfulness and focus and concentration and attention to truth and attention to goodness and righteousness and so on. Very easy to say something that is hurtful, very easy to let anger dictate our speech, greed dictate our speech, delusion dictate our speech, very quick. Speech is not a hard thing to accomplish, not like action. And it can be incredibly hurtful. It can destroy the harmony of an entire monastery just by speech. The second is restraint of the mind. So the mind is not really something you can restrain. The mind is not like a person. The Buddha likened the mind to a beast. The mind is not really like a beast. But the Buddha used this term, he likened it to a beast in the sense that it's unlike any other beast. Because a normal beast is sarirang, it has a physical body. The Buddha said the mind is asarirang. It has no body, no form. It's not something you can cage, it's not something you can obviously restrain. It does what it wants. Even any practitioner of insight meditation can attest to this. You don't want to think about the past, your mind thinks about the past. You don't want to think about the future, you think about the future. The mind is not under our control. It's incredibly flighty, fickle, unsteady, unstable. And so this one is the hardest, the restraint of the mind. It's why we have specific activities that allow us to focus all of our attention on the training of the mind, not the restraint or control of the mind, but the training of it. And it's this training, the training in mindfulness, where you walk and you pay attention to the foot, and where you sit and pay attention to the stomach, and in general, where you confront your experiences and try to see them just as they are. It's why we use this mantra as a means of training the mind and dictating to the mind the true nature of reality, rather than allowing it to get lost in delusion, illusion, partiality, judgment, stress, and suffering. We keep the mind present, we keep the mind focused, we keep the mind objective, we keep the mind honest. Or this is what we cultivate. This is why meditation is such a core part of the Buddha's teaching, because speech and action, physical action, don't arise or don't have significance without the mind to impel them. So again, if our speech is not colored by greed, colored by anger, colored by delusion, it really is innocent and without any lasting or meaningful consequences. Of course, misunderstandings can still occur, but have no effect on our own peace and happiness and freedom from suffering. It's only when the mind becomes disturbed and upset that we act and speak in cruel ways. The mind is, of course, the essence of the focus of the Buddha's teaching, as should be well known, that this is what we're trying to guard. We guard the mind, we restrain the mind, but we restrain it the only way possible, through mindfulness, not through control, not through forcing, but through confronting, through acknowledging, through objectively facing our experiences, whatever they might be. And the third is the restraint of the body. The Buddha says one should not perform any unwholesomeness with body, not even the slightest unwholesomeness, not even the slightest violence towards others, or act which could cause sorrow or stress or suffering for another being. You can also say that any action can be considered unwholesome if it is done without mindfulness. So on a deeper level, the teaching here is that all of our actions should be done with mindfulness, because they become habitual and they are amplified. Our emotions are amplified, they amplify. Our activities amplify our emotions. So for example, someone like a child who stomps around their room, it encourages their anger. If we allow our bodies to become worked up through anxiety or fear, then that stress in the body, the experiences in the body can provide a feedback loop, triggering further anxiety, further stress, and leading to an outright panic attack. There's this sort of build-up and build-up and build-up that comes because of the physical activity. So our mindfulness of the body, not only being the easiest way to initially cultivate mindfulness, is also a very important means of allowing mindfulness to grow and to continue, because our actions are an amplification of our mind states. And so everything that we do should be done with mindfulness in order to not allow for the hindrances and the defilements to grow and to flourish. So walking mindfully, eating mindfully, any activity that we perform can be a breeding ground for defilements, like eating, for example. If we eat without mindfulness, then we're cultivating most likely greed, also probably aversion, as some of the food we're not going to like and some of the food we're going to like. Without mindfulness, it can be a real disruption to our practice, a source of disturbance and inquietude, and a source of greed, a source of further greed, anger, and delusion, and a real disturbance to our strength of mind and our purpose of mind and our progress on the path of the Buddhist teaching. So it's a really valuable practical way of looking at life and practice and the Buddha's teaching in general. How to live your life. Remember, there are only three doors by which we can perform ethical or unethical acts. And if we're constantly considering and applying ourselves to these three, just these three, we have a good chance of cultivating wholesome qualities and progressing on the Buddha's teaching and finding our way towards true peace, happiness, and freedom from suffering, guarding our speech, being careful about what we say, and just generally being mindful so that if we are angry, we don't speak based on the anger. If we're greedy, we don't try to manipulate others based on our speech. And if we are deluded, arrogant, conceited, we're just careful not to allow it to perpetuate and to create stress and suffering. And more importantly, we eventually work to free ourselves from these mental qualities. We guard the mind and we train the mind and we create a mind that is restrained, that is not controlled, but kind of self-controlled in the sense that it is quieted, it is ordered, orderly, it is strong and firm and unshakable and unshaken by experiences. And we watch the body. Ultimately, the body is our best friend in terms of the cultivation of the Buddhist teaching, the cultivation of mindfulness. We use the body to walk back and forth, so that becomes the object of mindfulness. We use the body or to breathe, and so the breath, the movement of the stomach becomes our object. And these things are our best tools, being so coarse and so obvious and so clear, allowing us to cultivate wholesome qualities of mind, focus of mind, and to learn to understand the nature of our bodies and mind, and to free ourselves from all of these dangerous qualities that could lead us to such evil so quickly, just like this monk who ended up as a pig-headed, butt-mouthed, maggot-spewing